Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
Here's something you might not know about wireless. Sometimes what you see isn't what you get. But with Visible, what you see is what you get. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 per month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Variety is back with its annual Entertainment Marketing Summit on April 24th at the luxurious Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles. This must-attend event for entertainment marketers will feature conversations with leaders from Netflix, Paramount, Activision, Mattel, LA Rams, Google, and more. Plus, an exclusive keynote conversation with Paris Hilton. The networking opportunities are unbeatable. And once you register, you can start chatting with other registrants to plan a meetup at the lunch or cocktail hour. Limited tickets are available, so secure your spot today at events.variety.com.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to this episode of the Weekly Zeitgeist. These are some of our favorite segments from this week, all edited together into one nonstop infotainment laugh extravaganza. So without further ado, here is the Weekly Zeitgeist.
Hey, who's that in our third seat? A very funny comedian, the host of the podcast, the Frogcast, Pod Yourself a Gun, and now Pod Yourself the Wire. It's Matt Lee.
Hey, I'm here, baby. I'm here, and good to be back. I was here just the other day,
Filling in.
We're just like, man, Matt, you got to come back immediately.
Yeah,
because you just crushed it. In the guest host.
More Lieb.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, more Lieb. More Lieb the better. So I'm excited.
More Lieb time.
That's right.
If I could get a little more Lieb time on that.
Yeah, a little more Lieb time. And thanks for plugging the the Pod Yourself the Wire, which is, you were on Pod Yourself a Gun, our Sopranos rewatch podcast, and we did all the episodes, and now we're at The Wire. So I'm going to need both of you guys to come on and talk about The Wire at some point.
It is my favorite show of all time.
It's a great show. It's a great show. And here's the thing. If you're listening to this right now and you're like, oh, I haven't seen those shows, doesn't matter. You can still listen to the podcast. And if you're like, I don't want to listen to the podcast, that's fine. The most important thing is just giving us 5 stars in a review on the Apple Podcast Store. That's all I care about.
There you go.
Subscribe. Then press play on the episode and then mute it.
And then walk away. It's an act of charity to do those things. Please help. I have a baby.
Yeah. There aren't that many movie, TV podcasts that I will give the go ahead and listen to this even if you're not watching the show. But yours is one of them because it is a comedy show and it's fun. It's fun to listen to. Although you should watch the fucking Wire and the Sopranos.
You should absolutely watch the Wire.
It's weird to not watch those shows. Yeah. Just because it's like, what else are you watching? What's in the way of those?
Right.
Nothing you're watching is as good as either The Sopranos or The Wire. And nothing you're listening to is as good as those two rewatch podcasts, Pod Yourself a Gun and Pod Yourself the Wire. So please help.
With the obvious exception of the Daily Zeitgeist.
Right. I was going to say that.
Of course.
Yeah. I don't want to start a beef here, Matt.
But there's no beef, but it's like, you guys don't rewatch enough TV on this podcast. And that, I think, has been the main problem I've seen in various Daily Zeitgeist guys' comment sections.
Yeah.
They're like, how come they're not talking about my favorite story?
Just exactly.
Completely misunderstanding it as a Wire rewatch podcast. All
our comments, I don't remember any comments. Of these episodes about The Wire where the queen was dead.
That is truly what you get when you like launch a podcast. The first few weeks of episodes of reviews are just like, you know, reviewing a different podcast that your title made them think your show was going to be.
Yeah.
Exactly. Wait, Matt, I want to... Okay, episodes. Either the one where the wiretapping goes completely haywire and blows up in everybody's face, or Omar's first on-screen gay kiss. I'll do either.
Oh, yeah.
Iconic moments for me.
We just did the first Omar gay kiss episode.
Oh, so
unfortunately, you can't do that one, but... There's plenty of The Wire Goes Haywire episodes. That's the thing about The Wire. It's mostly a show about, you know, wires. Various types.
And they do, if you haven't seen it, they do constantly say things like, this has gone haywire and looks like we've got our wires crossed. And too much coffee for me. I'm wired.
I'm wired. It's mostly a show of wire puns.
Choice.
Yeah. It's a weird to have such a serious and important show be filled with random
self-referential titular wire puns.
Exactly. Titular wire puns. Oh, man. You know what my favorite magazine is? Wired. Anyways, let's solve this murder.
Yeah. Joelle, I'm so excited for the segments where you're going to be coming on, telling us about all the movies you've pre-screened for us. And that will all be happening soon. What is something from your search history that is revealing about who you are?
Okay, yeah. So I tried to come up with something. So most of my search history, which I never really looked at, was about like things you can do with tahini. So that's not that interesting. Like that's like the most interesting thing I had. Or it's like, who's that guy on that TV show? That's basically all I use it for, is like when I'm watching TV, I Google like, you know, who this character actor is. But my friend, so I was asking my friend last night, and he was like, well, you could tell him, how much do you pee in your lifetime? That's something he Googled yesterday. This is a younger guy. He's like 24. So he's into that sort of thing. And it turns out you pee about 18,000 gallons over the course of your life, your average person. And that's about a half a swimming pool.
So wow.
I thought that was sort of interesting.
Wow. So no matter how hard you try your whole life, you could only fill half a swimming pool with your pee.
I mean, you could probably, I feel like, you know, you could try harder and get up a little bit, but your average user, you know,
so, I don't know. Why. I'm like kind of crestfallen hearing that. I don't know.
Yeah,
why.
That's like not enough pee for me. Yeah. I feel like I can do better than that. Is that an Olympic swimming pool?
Well, there's like an average swimming pool. I don't know what that means exactly. Like an average swimming pool is 35,000 gallons. So I feel like I could fill the swimming pool by the end if I make it like a long time.
So. If you work hard, stay hydrated, continue. There is a power washer going in the background just for added effect. But
your neighbor's trying to fill a pool right now.
Yeah.
I'm almost there, man. I'm almost there. I mean, because they say you do, maybe you pee between 4 and 10 times a day if everything's going right. Okay.
Is that right?
That's what they say.
That feels like a lot. 4 and 10. I guess 10 feels like a lot. 4 feels, but maybe not.
But I mean, we all have different size bladders. We all have different, you know, our peak, we all come from different pee backgrounds, you know, so sometimes you like to pee and the minute you have a sensation, other times you're working and you're like, I think I can get away with a couple more hours.
Yeah. Just burst. I like to, it speeds. If you've ever heard this show and been like, are they on like 1.5 time? Like why is this like double speed?
That's you doing your the show's about to wrap pee.
That's me. That's me having to pee. Yeah. But anyways, fascinating stuff. I figured Pete's going to do something about how much we pee in our lifetimes. I just knew that was
knew that coming in. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm also curious, what can you do with tahini though? I'm also interested in tahini.
I mean, I started eating these, like, not because I'm like a particularly healthy person at all, like, but I just started eating these macrobiotic lunches years ago that are like, you know, just steamed vegetables and like tofu and this tahini sauce. And I got like everything else, you know, you kind of get sleepy after lunch. And this would just, you'd feel like running through a wall. And so I don't know. Then I got obsessed with tahini. I could put tahini on anything. Like just, you know, so I'm always trying to figure out just different versions of, I mean, again, that's why I didn't choose it, because it's kind of boring. You know, I just like, I'm like, can you put tahini instead of, you know, mustard on this thing? And, you know, like just trying to come up with different dressings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I love tahini. Yeah. And I remember when I found out it's like in desserts too. I was like, this thing is the most fucking malleable sauce I've ever seen.
They make a healthy Nutella that my wife ordered, but it's all all sesame tahini based. And there's like a little chocolate in it, but it's great. It's like, it's amazing. I got to remember the brand name, but I eat that like just out of the jar.
The chocolate hummus really fucks me up because it does taste so good. But I don't know. Like my brain doesn't know what to do with it. It's just
is that real? Are you making a joke?
Yeah, chocolate hummus is... No. Chocolate hummus is like something you can get at Ralph's. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember seeing Trader Joe's for the first time. Like, we're doing too much Trader Joe's. And then every listener was like, you think it looks and sounds fucked up. And then you eat it. And then you realize you are fucked up.
Yeah, and then you realize you are the one.
You are the fucked up one. Yeah. The other reason I bring it up is the salt. Have you ever had like a millionaire bar with tahini and caramel?
That's like the thing. That sounds all right, though.
Oh, my God. You make your own salted caramel with like a cookie base and like this caramel tahini filling, and it's like vegan, excellent dessert.
Wait, what do you mean you make your own?
I've never bought a millionaire bar, but someone like made it like a home recipe, like they made it on their own. And ever since then, it's one of my favorite desserts that I've had involving tahini too.
All right, I'm Googling that right after.
Yeah,
right
millionaire bars.
Yeah. All right.
Wow. Millionaire bar. I'd never even heard of that.
Yeah, super easy to make too.
I maxed out at the 100 grand bar. What is something you think is overrated?
Oh, wait, what did I write down? This is controversial. So I did not think I was going to jump right into controversy.
Let's go.
Let's do it.
That something that as an expert I believe is overrated is recycling.
Okay.
Go on.
Okay, you didn't think I was going to say that. Now, I'm not saying don't recycle, but if you learn more about
how
effective recycling is, you will learn that it is a freaking disaster. The whole system is a hot mess, and recycling does not reach or even come close to reaching the goals we think it does. In a lot of ways, there's an argument it does more harm than good. Like, it takes a lot of fossil fuel emissions to recycle things, like to turn like aluminum or glass into new aluminum and glass. It actually like we have to pollute a lot to get that done. There's like so many issues with it.
Right.
So a solution, please keep recycling, but like even better, reduce your consumption and reuse the things that you consume. So like emphasis on reduce and reuse, recycling's overrated.
Yep. Mm. I was shamed by my reusable shopping bags, like the thick plastic ones that a lot of the stores got around like the thin bag ban with. They're like, well, now we give reusable ones out. And I was just like, I could make a submarine if I melted all this plastic down, like
it's
full
still
size.
Plastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And I don't throw it away too, because part of me's like, you can't recycle that shit. And I'm like, I don't want to waste it. So then eventually I am like able to use those a little bit better. But now I always bring my big ass like reusable bag with
you're
me
like
because,
canvas tote
because yes, I've been thoroughly just put into a state of panic over like how terrible I am with that kind of stuff.
Reduce and reuse, that's the way.
And it's wild how much packaging stuff too like says it has like a recycling logo on it, yet you have to go take some things to like specialized places. Like you can't just put that in like your city recycling can sometimes.
Wait, I learned you will die. I recently learned, again, I just got a whole like proper education on this. So now I can speak as an expert. I recently learned that in like several states in this country, it is legal to put a recycling symbol on anything, even if it's not recyclable.
What?
Like there's just a like loophole as a design? And people use the loophole.
They're like, it's just good marketing for recycling.
It's kind of like it's kind of like saying if you can figure out a way to recycle this, go ahead. Yeah, but we don't have a way.
Wow.
That's so American. It's wild. It is so American. Anyway, so like don't think you're doing something by recycling. It is overrated. There are better ways. Reduce, reuse at a minimum.
Yeah. Right. I just like to collect those plastic bags that have the big recycling thing on it because it proves that I'm here to save the earth. As many of those as I can have.
Conscious.
Mm-hmm.
What's something you think is underrated?
Underrated gravel bikes, which is a type of bike.
Oh, so the in-between bike. Yeah.
The in-between bike. It's like more comfortable because I was shopping for a bicycle and I was trying to decide. I've been like cycling a lot more and I wanted to up my bike game. So I was looking at these really expensive bikes and I'm like, I don't really know if I can spend this type because bikes are really expensive if I can spend this money on it. And basically what I was told is that for what I do, like what 50 to 60, 70 miles a week or whatever, like it's good
Damn,
to have
son.
A, yeah, that's right. And that's, and yeah.
Where are you going? Did you give up your car?
What
are you
And all gravel.
No,
who are you trying to impress?
I'm sorry. I drive it around on my car. I got a bike rack for my car and I put it on my car and I drive it around 50 to 70 miles.
Gotcha.
So you keep the odometer on so that like it just assumes that you're riding that fast. Right. Yeah. Exactly. That's
this bike, oh man, like, this bike thinks I'm so cool.
I put on the Apple Watch. And so basically what I learned is that a gravel bike, especially now because streets are just such
awful
shit. And so streets are gravel, you know, big holes in them. And essentially it has a larger, slightly larger tire and it's a hybrid. So you can still go fast on the road if you want to, like, you know, if that's something you're into. But also when you go to these bumpy, more hazardous terrain things, you know, like you are still comfortable, like you're not going to be shaken out of your mind. So
yeah,
if you're looking for a bike and you're not trying to like enter a major race, I really, really enjoyed it. Gravel bike.
It's a road bike. You don't have to trip about if you start seeing dirt in front of you, and it's a mountain bike that won't feel super fucking slow just on asphalt.
Yeah, perfectly put. Yeah. Yeah.
There you
exactly.
go.
And look, shout out all the Bike Zeit gang, because I got a bike recently, but I got an electric bike just to kind of like zip around like where I live so I don't have to use my car. I was also looking at that thing. I'm like, God damn, these bikes are so much fucking money. But then at the end of the day, you're like, if I'm going to put a lot of time on it, then like you can kind of begin to rationalize like why a quality bike is that.
But yeah,
yeah, it'll be a long time since I buy a bike that is thousands of dollars.
Is there any way just everything is expensive right now? Like I feel like everyone I talk to who's like in the market for something, like my car lease is coming up and I like went and met with a Volvo dealer and they were like, yeah, so you're looking at like, it'll be like at least two times what you used to pay for your current car for the past 3 years. Like at least two times. They're like, yeah, it's the way the market is right now.
Is it?
Well, cars are right now, especially because of the tech supply chain stuff. But that's definitely taking a hit.
Or are we trusting that? I feel like we just gave everybody the license. We were just like inflation. And then everyone was like dope and raised their prices like three times the. Yeah.
I still go by the same thing where I'm like, if it's too much, I'm like, no. I ain't doing that.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'm good.
I went to this one place where they were showing me a bike. It was $6,000.
Oh, my God.
In my vanity, I'm like, maybe these big legs of mine deserve a $6,000,
right.
Which is not even, it would financially ruin me if I bought a $6,000.
Was the salesman like, legs like those? Nah, you're going to need one of these $6,000 guys.
And then I started blushing and I lost my ability to see. And that's how you get me. And they had like electric, like the brakes were, the shifters were electric. So you don't have to press the shifter too hard. It's still a bike that you pedal.
Too much
like,
of a luxury.
Which is crazy. It's a crazy luxury. And I went to this place called ATX Bikes in Austin and they like found me a bike. He's like, you don't need any of this shit. Like, just get this bike. And I did. And it's been great.
Just get this bike, asshole.
Get this bike. Take those plumpers coming out of your pelvis and put them on this bike. Yeah. And I was like, that's the most disgusting way to speak I've ever heard. But
God. Oh, man.
Los Siento.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the return of Q.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Variety is back with its annual Entertainment Marketing Summit on April 24th at the luxurious Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles. This must-attend event for entertainment marketers will feature conversations with leaders from Netflix, Paramount, Activision, Mattel, LA Rams, Google, and more. Plus, an exclusive keynote conversation with Paris Hilton. The networking opportunities are unbeatable. And once you register, you can start chatting with other registrants to plan a meetup at the lunch or cocktail hour. Limited tickets are available, so secure your spot today at events.variety.com.
And we're back, and we are joined by super producer Trisha Mukherjee.
Hello, good to be here. Hi, everyone.
Yeah. So you, were reading through Dr. Ray's work and listening to her podcast, and you begged us to come on to talk to her you put together a nice story, just like highlighting some of the really fascinating aspects of her work. So you want to take us through it?
Yes, of course. So I was reading about your work, Dr. Ray, and it was amazing. First of all, I would recommend that everyone listens to your podcast. Going Wild is the name, right?
Yeah. Going Wild with Ray Wynn-Grant. That's right. Mm-hmm. Named it after myself.
Nice. Smart.
Good title.
And so I was reading, I was seeing all these really adorable pictures of you with baby bear cubs and with like snakes and lemurs and all these other animals. It was great. But as I was looking through these photos and just reading about your work the hard science part of it, as well as environmental justice, I was just thinking a lot about people of color in nature, in these fields that focus on the outdoors. I love the outdoors. I really like long distance cycling and trekking and all these other adventure sport type things. But it's so rare that I see other people of color while I'm doing these things. So I know that you've also talked about this a lot. I wanted to look into why this is, you know, the history behind people of color feeling unwelcome in the outdoors and what we can do about it today.
Yeah, you were talking about a book that you read, Black and Brown Faces in America's Wild Places.
Yeah. So it was just this book that I came across a long time ago, and it was just the most simple concept. It was just photos of people of color in nature, like happy walking, you know, among the greenery.
Imagine that.
Yeah. Like, and I was actually shocked to see it because it made me so happy, first of all. But I was like, why does this look weird? It shouldn't look weird. Mm. Like, why has society made this right. something to marvel at?
You know what, Trisha? There are some really beautiful photos of Dr. Martin Luther King and his family in like recreating in nature, and you never see them, right? Like, we always say we see the same pictures of Martin Luther King. Yeah. And like, these photos are beautiful, and they also seem like strange, like, oh, weird, like, you know, the 60s,
it's like, what was that photo
a black
shoot?
Family, yeah, like in like in the forest, you know, yeah, it's just, it's society has given us this idea that like, you know, we've been socialized to believe that people of color don't exist in nature. We're like urban only.
Yeah. And like internalized it to the point where I even remember being like, nah, I don't do that. Like white friends would be like, we're going to go camp. I'm like, nah, I don't camp. Like, this is not, I have no concept of people that look like me doing that. So it never occurred to me to engage with nature like in that sense too. But I'm sure like anything in this country, we have, you know, we can draw lines back to an earlier mm-hmm. time where mm-hmm. we completely misunderstood our relationship to each other or the land, right?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because I can remember even a few years ago in ads for companies like REI or Patagonia, all these outdoors brands, it was all white people. Yeah. And now they've slowly started to kind of realize that it's an issue. And you see more people of color in those ads, which gives me a lot of hope. I mean, I remember the first time I saw a South Asian person in one of those ads, and it was great. It's like, well, another one. But yeah, so it's changing. But if we go way back and we think about this idea of nature in general, we think about the white settlers that came to what is now the United States and how they really just tore apart the lifestyle of indigenous peoples who lived on the land before then. They thought of land as something that needed to be protected, preserved, something that you live in harmony with rather than exploit, in this very capitalist settler mindset that eventually became the norm. And when settlers came, they introduced this idea of an untouched wilderness, you know, just trees and forests and rivers, somewhere where nobody lived. And if we dig a little deeper into that idea, you just see that that's not true, because there are people who live with the land and they live on it, but it's still, you know, it's still respected. And a proponent of this idea was John Muir, who's a very famous mm-hmm. environmentalist. I'm sure everyone's heard his name.
Sierra Club. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And he said that this land should be set aside for recreation to fulfill an emotional need for wild places, which I thought was just an absolutely ridiculous statement, because there were so many people, especially indigenous peoples, who were kicked off that land. And like, what about their emotional needs and what about their emotional fulfillment?
Him constantly like romanticizing like the wild lands that were basically free of indigenous people, you know, really opened the door for this kind of like exclusionary thinking and like, who gets to enjoy the environment? Like, would always juxtapose like the beauty of the landscapes, but these dirty faced, half happy, you know, like just all kinds of like terrible derogatory statements about indigenous people, black people. And he always would say, like, he used a quote that these indigenous people, quote, seem to have no right place in the landscape, which right. we saw that kind of like extend to like, especially like in colonial Africa, as like game reserves are opened up. This same idea of like, oh, people have lived here for centuries. No, I don't know. This is a theme park for white tourists. Like the Maasai people were just kicked out of certain places. Like there's a lot of history of just like the same thinking of like, hi, nature. Nobody should be here unless it's us just looking at it to just take a load off. And
so reactionary. Like,
right.
I agree with what y'all are both saying. And I think John Muir is such a good example, because he and his way are romanticized in our society, because he was thinking about solutions, right? Like there was a problem and he's like, oh, a solution is to right. do this. But I get frustrated when like, I feel like no one talks about the problem he was trying to find a solution mm-hmm. for, right? The problem was that like white men on this continent like decimated all of nature. And then right. at some point we're like, oh shoot, like if we don't stop and like preserve a little bit, we're going to have none left. I have an idea. Like, what if we asked John Muir to like create national parks for us? Like, so yeah, that was a solution. It one harmed people, you know, two, it didn't like work the way we wanted it to. It was completely unfair, unjust, and inequitable. But also like a better thing to do would be to like have like not done all of that like right. development of the land and destruction of, you know, wildlife and wild communities and wild places to begin with. And no one's talking about that, because that was done by the same like social group of people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like yeah. Teddy Roosevelt was like, we need national parks. Teddy Roosevelt like killed countless animals. Like we cannot count how many wild animals he killed across the world. He killed so many animals like for fun, for sport, not to eat them. Right.
Right.
And then he's the same person being like, hey, like let's do a national park thing. Like that's being environmentally friendly. Mm-hmm. Like
right.
what? Like these people were hypocrites. And it is very unpopular in my line of work to call that out. So I appreciate y'all doing it. I appreciate y'all like trying to really reimagine how we talk about environmental history, especially from the American perspective. But, you know, just in general, like our society and like the environmental movement does not largely accept that these people were problematic.
Yeah, right. Which is wild because I remember at the time people were defending. I remember, you know, the head of the Sierra Club in the summer of 2020 was sort of like, hey, if we're going to talk about Fort Bragg and these Confederates and like renaming stuff, we should really look at people like John Muir and things like that. And a lot of people are like, we can't be applying these purity tests or trying to say, look, well, look at all the good that he did. Sure. But to then like ignore that and also say that the way the early conservation movement was even looking at like what people's relationship was to the land kind of put a lot of terrible momentum behind like this ideology now is obviously worth like examining. Does that like does that tension still exist between conservationists where some people are like, we just got to keep this nice and that's it, just conserve that, versus people like, oh, we're completely ignoring the heaviest part of this conversation.
It's a mess. And I don't want anyone to think that like it's doom and gloom and there's no reason to have hope. Like that's not it. But basically the model of conservation, like to Trisha's point, has always been a neo-colonial, white supremacist, patriarchal model. Always. Mm-hmm. Like we don't have a new one that is like globally accepted. And so I would say like these days there are enough like revolutionary radical thinkers in the conservation movement that are like helping to like reject these ideas. But in general, like conservation is still a neocolonial force, like both within and outside of this country. And I'll just like add in a little science tidbit, right? Please. Like instead of the like social stuff, like one of the main science tidbits that is also super challenging is that the majority of wild animals, and in particular, like large carnivores, like I study, like the big ferocious, like toothy ones, live outside of protected areas, like most of them, like almost all of them.
Really?
So it's like many of them live in a protected area. Like if you go to Yellowstone, you're going to see some bears and that is cool. But most bears live outside of Yellowstone and outside of Yosemite and outside of these places in places that are not protected areas that are just like regular spots. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and I feel so, like
And so it's like, obviously the protected area system hasn't been a good model for many, many social reasons, but also for like actual scientific reasons, it's not like hitting it.
They're like these animals, like these animals,
like they're not like fenced. Yeah, these animals aren't like, oh, like I just stepped outside my boundary. Like, let me pull up a map and
the
make
Disney
sure.
World approach to like conservation.
So funny. Yeah. Yeah, it's like largely not working, and yet like protected areas have popped up all over the world because a few of these men, like from 120 years ago, thought like, you know, didn't think twice and just like went for it.
And to Miles, your point about like there was a reckoning with the, you know, white supremacist John Muir and, you know, his role in founding the Sierra Club. So I just went to Yosemite with my family and it felt like we had traveled to like a monument to John Muir. Like parks and trails had signs quoting his wisdom and there were, you know, stories about him coming to the land for the first time, like he had just discovered it, you know?
Yeah.
Right. He looks like a Confederate general. And it's, you know, you can't decouple like his white supremacist viewpoint from all of that. And the work that he's deified for is, it involves ignoring or outright being hostile towards, you know, the people who were already there.
Yeah, do they have his quotes about how he spoke about black people in Georgia when he first encountered them?
They did not.
I don't think they have that.
How well-trained they were, as he put it. Yeah, like, that's the funny thing is, like, you know, we have this way of being like, but all this other good stuff, but all this other good stuff. And that's true. That's true, too. And so is this.
Yeah.
And you have to reckon with all of that. And you have to say how influential this person was and how much, like, even when they say, like, well, he never like actually supported some of these other racists that like hung on to every word he said. It's like, yeah, but he never actually denounced it either. Mm-hmm. And that, yeah. and that creates the space for other people to be like, well, I don't know, maybe.
And he knew that creating protected areas was destroying communities and you know, whether it was like direct or indirectly killing people, like literally like ruining people's lives. It was people of color. So it was like, it's okay.
Yeah. Well, the very first public park, it wasn't officially Yosemite yet because it was way back when, but it was where Yosemite is now. And that park was created by literally just slaughtering hundreds of indigenous people to have that as a space of enjoyment.
And
hey, what could be more American?
Yeah. It's right.
Awful. On this place where you ignore, you're having a good time, willfully ignore how this space came about and go on with your day. Good day.
And let me add, because this is complicated for me as someone who holds a belief system, but still has to work within the confines
navigate that space,
of
right.
The system that my job is in. But indigenous people still exist they existed in abundance in the past, but they still exist in abundance, and so it's not like they were slaughtered and died and now we have these national parks. Folks deserve to have their land back, you know. They're asking for it, they're demanding it, it goes without saying, it is deserved. And so, you know, someone like me, I often struggle with feeling so hypocritical because I work in protected areas, right? I study large carnivores in protected areas while holding the view that if I had any power here, I would give the land back. Right. It doesn't make sense to me to be ringing the bell of yay, we're doing better. We're creating conservation solutions. We have more animals, when people and communities are still obstructed from engaging in and stewarding their land the way that they want to. I have a good feeling that a lot of indigenous communities would choose to do wonderful quote unquote conservation work. They probably wouldn't call it conservation, but just conservation-ish work on these landscapes. But even if they didn't want to do that, they should be able to do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And it's really a tension that I have within myself where I'm okay, you know, sometimes I try to give myself a break and say, this is the best I can do, is do my job within the confines of the structure. But land back in America, at least, is something that I think the people who believe in it don't necessarily have the power to make it come true. And that's really, really frustrating because there are people out there who have the power.
And land back is quite literally anathema. It's the antithesis of manifest destiny. It's land back?
Right.
No. We got here being God told me I could have this. And now you're saying take backs? No. I feel that's...
Yeah, people feel that's unfair. You know, I have to say I do a lot of work in parts of rural American West, which is always an adventure.
Yes.
And it is interesting because there's a lot of folks out there, you know, again, I'll use some cattle ranchers as an example, who are really kind of grappling with the fact that it's an uncertain future in cattle ranching, right? Just because of the economy and society and just the market, it's just not, it used to be super profitable and it's not, that guarantee isn't still there. And so a lot of folks are kind of should our family continue to cattle ranch? Should we sell our land? And I just sit around there being wow. Mm. A lot of people still consider this to be their land because their great, great granddaddy, you know, took it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
But I don't see people having conversations about the equitable choice here.
Right.
Mm. Right.
Which I'd imagine there's a scientific argument for all of that. You know, I can't imagine science would argue against it. They're good custodians of that land and we shouldn't.
There is a scientific argument. I mean, worldwide, globally, one thing that we know and that we have been able to prove as scientists is that poverty and environmental wellness are directly linked to each other. So we cannot necessarily achieve a healthy environment without alleviating or eliminating poverty. And we can't alleviate or eliminate poverty without creating a healthy functioning environment and healthy ecosystems. And so land back is a really good argument for alleviating poverty in many places, which thus helps the environment be healthier and stronger and more resilient. And yet it's like, it's just like easy, you know, it's hard to break out of these molds at which we've been taught and to really decolonize this whole perspective and approach to conservation. But really, like, when communities of people are healthy and well, the environment is more likely to be healthy and well, and vice versa.
Right. Yeah. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll keep talking about this.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Variety is back with its annual Entertainment Marketing Summit on April 24th at the luxurious Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles. This must-attend event for entertainment marketers will feature conversations with leaders from Netflix, Paramount, Activision, Mattel, LA Rams, Google, and more. Plus, an exclusive keynote conversation with Paris Hilton. The networking opportunities are unbeatable. And once you register, you can start chatting with other registrants to plan a meetup at the lunch or cocktail hour. Limited tickets are available, so secure your spot today at events.variety.com.
And we're back, and let's talk about TikTok.
Yeah, speaking of hating the fucking status quo.
Yeah, because so a recent study from UCLA asked teens what kind of stories they wanted to see on TV, and they were like, TV? Huh?
Oh, what? For real?
Okay.
I mean, you mean like that shit my aunt watches? but I mean, it really shows, right, that like, it's the results aren't really surprising given how savvy like younger people are. One of the biggest takeaways that they were talking about was that in terms of television content, they do not want to see aspirational shows. Less than 5% of the respondents in the survey said they were interested in shows about kids with like impossible lavish lifestyles, like, you know, like Gossip Girl. Entourage type shit where it's like, whoa, look, oh my God, take me to your world of excess. Not really into that anymore. A whopping 21% want shows that deal with real world issues like family dynamics or social justice. They don't want sanitized portrayals of the world they're experiencing, essentially. They don't care to see these like very, you know, cookie cutter, like sort of versions of what they see as like a world wrought with problems that need to actually be like wrangled with. Goes on to say, quote, Hollywood has built its young adult content on the belief that teens want to see glamorous lifestyles and rich and famous characters. But our research suggests the opposite is true. We know from this and our race and class in teen TV study, the majority of teens feel isolated and upset when media lack accurate identity representations.
Mm-hmm.
Like they look at this and go, this is not real. Who is that? That's not a real person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nearly 27% wanted more black male heroes and 35% wanted more white male villains. And rather than aspirational stories, they want underdog stories about people beating the system or overcoming oppression.
Mm.
Like, It's like truly the status quo of like, and everyone lived happily ever after in their impossible apartments in the Upper West Side. Like that's not really moving the needle. And I think young people have felt like this for a while. Millennials, we didn't really have any options. So we were always just like, I don't know what's on the big seven channels.
Right.
And we'll kind of take that for what it is. But because of social media, it's offering a lot of people different options. Like 55% of these kids said that they prefer social media in terms of like entertainment because it's where the authentic content lives.
Right. It's there's not the barrier and the, you know, there, nobody is demanding that every work of social media gets approved by a 55-year-old white guy who's completely out of touch with fucking everything.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Like that makes total sense. And it also, like, things are moving so quickly and it makes sense that this generation would be even more different for, like, in terms of their tastes and stuff, given that, like, the information and entertainment environment, like, ecosystem that they grew up in is totally foreign from the one that people 5 years older from them grew up in.
Right. Know? Like, you could go on TV and watch, you know, something on CNN where they're going to be talking about, like, well, what really is on Hunter Biden's laptop? Or you can go on TikTok and, like, watch somebody make a funny sketch about, like, American imperialism in Asia.
Right.
And you're like, damn, this shit's fucking true and funny and a topic that they won't discuss. Like, it's just subject matter I won't see, or all kinds of, like, any other sort of interest you might have. Is sort of either you're going to get this really mainstream sanitized version on television, or it's just not there at all. Like, you're not represented on television at all. So, of course, you know, like, as consumers, younger people are like, well, I'm not interested in this, like, sort of, you know, monotone version of what, you know, reality is based on Hollywood development, like meetings.
Right. Yeah. But I guess the problem, I don't know, what, like, people have argued that, like, TikTok is bad because it has, like, no fact checker working on it.
Sure.
And I think that's almost definitely true.
The problem with that is, like half the time, like, you know, there's, like, the New York Times doing something just absolutely terrible.
Exactly. Which,
you know, so then, I mean, it kind of goes out the window. I mean, it is a huge problem. You know, you get kids get there, like, you know, like my son is so, like, well, you know, versed in politics, it's great. Like, and he's learned it all from social media, you know, I mean, I think, but, and he's definitely formulated pretty smart opinions, at least coming from my vantage point, you know, like, where they're like, they're nuanced, and he's like, yeah, obviously I don't take it at, you know, face value what I'm seeing, but I don't know if it's any better than the New York Times. I mean,
yeah, you
know,
I was gonna say that, like, the TikTok at least is like, just like firing random lies at the wall of all different, going
hey,
in all different directions.
And NyQuil. Okay.
The New York Times misinformation is like coordinated and all going in the same direction to the point that you are like, you could easily be mistaken into thinking like, that's just reality.
Yeah. I mean, just on paper, there are plenty of campaigns on, like, traditional media or social media that are made to create some sentiment that isn't there, for sure. But I think, yeah, it's like, what are you dealing with that's different by looking at the two? And I think, you know, one of the things that they just talk about is just, if you are, because I think most people are savvy, like, I guess most people that I know that are, like, younger and looking at TikTok seem to be pretty savvy, where they don't always just accept everything they see as, like, gospel truth, like, that they are a little bit, you know, suspicious.
Yeah. Well, it's easier to be savvy with those two. I mean, like, with the New York Times, for instance, like, when I read the New York Times, I still don't understand where they're coming from. Like, you know, like, I don't, like, what is the end goal with those guys? Like, you know, when, like, obviously they do a lot of great reporting, but, like, when there's one of these pieces that's, like, just absolutely, like, pushing this, like, this agenda, this New York Times agenda, we're all kind of like, okay, I know what this is, like, they're doing it again. But then you're like, who's doing this? And, like, why? And I don't even understand who these people, like, there isn't, like, a group of people who really support that other than the New York Times themselves. It's like,
it's interesting. I was thinking about this with regards to inflation, right? Because that was, like, a question that keeps occurring to me as they write about inflation, and the story they're telling is like not convincing, not interested. Like it doesn't really hold together. And it's like based in this world of like supply and demand where like it's like the zero gravity theoretical world of, you know, inflation and, you know, the rates and this. And it's like it makes me wonder if they're pitching stories that are more grounded in reality and people's like day-to-day experiences and, you know, what you actually hear on earnings calls and like see companies doing. Like if they're pitching those stories and somebody at the editorial level is like, no, write about how it's because people ask for too much money and raises, you know,
yeah.
or is it that all of these, I think it probably is somewhere between that and all these New York Times journalists like went to these Ivy League schools that teach you that you are like a better person. You are a higher level of person because of these like technocratic truths that you are steeped in about like, cause you took econ from like somebody who is like a world striding fucking captain of industry. And so you like, you have very deep inside of you this connection between this overarching narrative that like it can all be explained with math and, you know, moving things around, and it is actually a meritocracy. Like that kind of ties into your overall view of yourself. And so like at a cellular level, at a like journalist by journalist level, they are also like bought into this idea of,
yeah, you know,
and that also makes sense. Like the self-confidence that just like, this is the way the world is, and I can't possibly see beyond that line.
Right.
There. Yeah.
I mean, just hearing from like multiple journalists of color on Twitter all the time saying the same thing. It's like they talk about the world through this worldview because the only people they recruit are coming from a similar worldview. So it doesn't even occur to question what their beliefs are. And on top of that, you're rewarded by the editor based on what your takes are. So if your take is a more employer-friendly view of the economy and not a worker-oriented view of the economy, an editor might reinforce that by being like, well, that person gets a lot of fucking work. Like, they get in the paper a lot more than I do because they're talking this way. And it's like any job where you look at, oh, my boss likes this more than this. And to stay stable in my job, there is a certain amount of like tailoring I will do of my own personality or interests to stay in my job, to get the plaudits that I want or the positive attention I want from my boss, et cetera. And it just kind of, and it services itself because at the end of the day, all of these people benefit from the status quo. And there's really like, so yeah, of course it bend over backwards, trying to normalize like fascist people like in the US because like, what are you going to do? Have a, like a real sober analysis on like what the world looks like through the eyes of someone with less money, because that doesn't really happen.
When we have people on here who like guests on the show who are like journalists or like, you know, they're freelance journalists, they're people who work like with mainstream media outlets to, you know, produce a podcast or something, like they work in some way in the world of nonfiction. A lot of times the sentiment like that they seem to give us after we like hit stop on the recording is, wow, so you guys can just like tell the truth on here. Like that's right. Crazy. Like it, like that they, there's just an unspoken thing at a lot of the places that are like major media outlets that you have to sort of curb what you say, like in order to get it published. Like you need to be sort of dancing on both sides of this thing instead of just being like, no, this is fucked. I don't know why we've gotten away with it for so long, but that, it's crazy to me. Do you know who I'm, like, the examples I'm talking about, Miles?
Of course.
Like,
and I think that shows, right, that in certain spaces, like, you're just conditioned to know that in a given industry, certain topics are just like third rail issues.
Right.
And not to say that it's like third rail and that like it's, you know, a fatal mistake you'll make in your career. But it's something that if you engage in has consequences. on some right. level, whether that means you may not get the kind of looks that you'd want to get into like a, you know, a maybe more mainstream publication, mm-hmm. or even if you're not even necessarily dealing with news, that within a given field of study or whatever, things are just spoken about a certain way. And to run counter to that is like you become a boat rocker.
Right.
And I think we still, like, there's still many areas where, like, boat rocking is absolutely, like, a no-no, you know? And there are other places where only recently it's like, okay, let's maybe, you know, let's not completely throw someone in the rubbish pile because they're pointing out systemic racism. Like, that used to be shit you couldn't really say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at that, like, that, I'm not well-versed enough about this to talk in a recording because I can't remember that much, but, like, that New Yorker story. Where there was a New Yorker journalist who I believe the woman, I think she's a black woman, who kind of called out the New Yorker. And I think New Yorker is just such an example of like, oh man, like I, you know, do trust so many people. Like there, like Steve Cole or Dexter Filkins, like there's some books of like New Yorker writers that I'm like, oh, those are great, you know? But like everybody turned on her, like David Remnick turned on, like they just sold her down. Yeah, I don't know if you guys know more about that story than I do. I just remember kind of reading it on Twitter, and this is like the most half-assed recital of it. But like, the, you know, the
this
editor
is like
sold,
in the last year,
like in the recently? Last like 3 months, I think. You know, like yeah, she sent out like a company memo or something, and then just got like
right,
just run out basically. You know, and it's like that's like the place where you'd be like that wouldn't happen because those people are smart right. and decent and wonderful. Right. Know, like, or so, you know, yeah. I mean, a lot of people would say that. So it's just a surprise, you know, there wasn't more backing for her, you know.
Yeah, I love the New Yorker. I love telling people when I read an article in the New Yorker and talking about it and, you know, just practicing reading comprehension so I look smart. But the, but they, like, I've had my eye on them ever since they covered Havana Syndrome with just like, perfect credulity and like basically CIA talking points. I've been like, huh, like maybe there's more there than meets the eye, because they have great writers, but like that doesn't stop them from having government contacts that they trade information for, or you know. But yeah, that does any mainstream journalistic institution at this point, I feel like, is probably, you know, prone to this sort of thing, at least.
It's weird.
Yeah. Well, and I think the biggest, like, we just have this pattern in like the world, especially in America, where like, if there is a adjacent controversy to something that's like a truth, it's much easier to pour all your energy into the adjacent controversy than to like examine the real thing that you need to.
Yeah.
So rather than looking, having a full reckoning of, you know, the effects of white supremacy in every industry, it became about white supremacy in policing.
Right.
And then companies were able to do this thing of like, yeah, and we're getting into it too. Yeah, we're gonna check. Yeah, we're also gonna really heavily invest in this without sincerely doing it. Many places have not sincerely do it because I think there's just like this pattern of like, well, if you grapple enough with the adjacent thing, you can avoid having a real reckoning with your own shit. But absolutely. You better go all in on whatever the scandal du jour is, because if you don't put all your energy and critique into that, then you will be seen as someone who's not taking a look at the truth here. And we see this all the time. It happened even with like the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It was much easier for the media to be like, I can't believe a country would invade another country. That is those are war crimes. This is unbelievable, while avoiding our own history as a nation doing that. The many other controversies that are comparable, but because they are not white faces, we'll just ignore it. Yeah. So again, adjacent controversy gave everybody the license to be like, yeah, and now everybody's feeling good about American foreign policy and shit because of Russia. It's we'll always see a thing. It can be any sport or whatever. If there's something near the truth, just go all in on that, because then you can avoid having to really look at your own shit, and then you can continue down this blind path of like repeating the same mistakes while, you know, feeling good about the little bit of attention you gave something for a couple weeks.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's Weekly Zeitgeist. Please like and review the show if you like the show. means the world to Miles. He needs your validation, folks. I hope you're having a great weekend, and I will talk to you Monday. Bye.
A lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Here's something you might not know about wireless. Sometimes what you see isn't what you get. But with Visible, what you see is what you get. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 per month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
Variety is back with its annual Entertainment Marketing Summit on April 24th at the luxurious Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles. This must-attend event for entertainment marketers will feature conversations with leaders from Netflix, Paramount, Activision, Mattel, LA Rams, Google, and more. Plus, an exclusive keynote conversation with Paris Hilton. The networking opportunities are unbeatable. And once you register, you can start chatting with other registrants to plan a meetup at the lunch or cocktail hour. Limited tickets are available, so secure your spot today at events.variety.com.